This is Jay-Z. You're tuned in to the Michael Eric Dyson Show.
You heard that right. Hov and Academic Mike trying to put it down like only we can. This is the Michael Eric Dyson Show, and today is something altogether different and special. We spend the entire hour with one of the greats, rapper, entrepreneur, CEO of Roc Nation, mogul, and now add to that title list, author. Jay-Z joins us to discuss his new book, Decoded.
Yeah, I started with some of the songs that needed the most decoding. I try to stick close to the central story, and the story is about that a generation of kids that grew up during the same time hip-hop grew up.
We go inside his music and talk about everything from his Brooklyn roots to his globe-spanning megastar. It's an hour you don't want to miss. That's Jay-Z coming right up. But first, this news. Welcome to the Michael Eric Dyson Show. Today I'm joined for the whole hour by a legitimate icon.
It is with the utmost pride and sincerity that I present this recording as a living testament and recollection of history in the making during our generation.
Allow me to reintroduce myself. My name is Hov. H to the O-V. I used to move snowflakes by the up. I guess even back then you can call me CEO of the ROC. Ho, fresh out the frying pan into the fire. I be the music biz number one supplier. Fly it in a piece of paper bearing my name. Got the hottest chick in the game wearing my chain. That's right, ho, ho. Not D-O-C, but similar to them letters. No one could do it better.
I check cheddar like a food inspector. Man, see how he breaks that down. A 10-time Grammy Award winner, corporate mogul, co-founder of Rockefeller Records, the Rockaware clothing label, and president of Def Jam Records, and now author. He has almost as many names as he has titles. Hova, J. Hova, Hov, Jigga, S. Carter. And the name his mother gave him, Sean Carter. But we know him as the one and only Jay-Z. He's here to talk about his brilliant new book, Decoded. Part memoir, part art book, part essay on the hip-hop community. It is a study on a generation and a genre. It offers bristling, brilliant, powerful insights that pop off of every page that really give us a sense of what a genius at work is like. From the laboratory of his own mind as he ruminates upon not only his past, but thinks about the critical present and the vital future of not only this art form, but of the possibility of art emanating from and emerging from spoiled and marginal and sometimes dissed communities. But from that has grown such a powerful culture that has had global attention and has now seized international authority. We welcome to this show a man who was able to critically analyze the social dynamics, the politics, and so much more in hip-hop. Jay-Z, welcome to the Michael Eric Dyson Show.
Man, I might have to use some of that intro right there.
Allow me to introduce my man. His name is Hov. Look, so let's start at the very beginning, which is pretty difficult, of course, given that you've said in the press for the book Decoded, that you're not a linear thinker. And I read this book, as the old people used to say, kiver to kiver, word for word. And you talk about not being a linear thinker. And that's one of the brilliant aspects of how your mind works, chasing down ideas, allowing the improvisational character of the great art that our people have produced and that America has produced. But it's not just about jazz or the musical art. It's also about Tarantino films and Warhol paintings and Jean-Michel Basquiat and all of this stuff. And trust me, you, my listening audience, if you want to get a sense of all of this, read this book because it's all there and you will see the kind of brilliance of this nonlinear thinking. And when we think about, however, where you came from, you know, I'm reminded of that lyric you talk about, and all my teachers couldn't reach me, and my mama couldn't beat me hard enough to match the pain of my pop not seeing me. So with that disdain in my membrane, got on my pimp game, blank the world, my defense came. So start us from there. Give us a conversation about what it was like to grow up in Brooklyn's Marcy Projects and what that world was like that you so brilliantly describe in the book.
Well, Marcy for us was, you know, it was our world. It was all we knew. We knew every nook and cranny of the projects. We knew where to hide. We knew where to run around. We knew around what time the ice cream man was coming, when the Johnny Pump was open. And, you know, it was these beautiful, wonderful, joyous moments. And it would be sometimes interrupted by extreme violence. So we had incredible highs and remarkable lows. I mean, at the, you know, age 9, I saw things that a 9-year-old wouldn't see anywhere. You know, people getting murdered in the hallway and things like that. So we had these extreme highs and these extreme lows. You know, sometimes, you know, morbid things became almost normal. You know, so you have to have this, you're almost desensitized to things that are atrocious. And it's, you know, you start building up callous. You start building up a wall. You know, if you've been hurt by your pop wasn't around. So, you know, you never allow people into your inner circle anymore because you don't want to feel that sort of hurt. And, you know, you start, all, you know, all these layers and complicated things that happen to you. And, you know, it defines who you are. And, you know, in writing the book, I thought it was important because human beings are so complex. That's why the book is, you know, part Tarantino, part Eric B. and Rakim, part Basquiat, part Warhol, part Kurt Cobain. You know, it's all these influences and all these things, you know, that make you who you are.
Absolutely. And all of those things and a lot more have made you who you are. You talk about the dissolution of your parents' marriage and how that affected you when you were 9 years old. You talk about that sense of abandonment and leaving that real scar. And yet that is not only your story, but the story of millions, unfortunately, of other young black men. But you talk about getting a chance later on to meet him. And in one of your songs, you talk about being at the tabernacle and how fake it would be for you to shed tears because you didn't know him that well. And yet there was a sense of intrigue about your relationship with him. You were able to grasp a sense of redemption, even though you'd only met him a little while before he died. Tell us about the meaningfulness of that, you know, encounter with your father.
You know, when I walked into the wake, I had so many questions. I was so intrigued by, you know, his appearance that I had more questions than pain, sadly, you know. Yeah, but my pop, you know, when I look back on it, and I, you know, there were things that I didn't know when I was young, you know, like so many others during that time, you know, their father left and they didn't even get to meet him. So I don't know what was worse. But for me, knowing my pop, you know, and having that relationship to when I was 9 and then having that taken away was so, I'm searching for the word. I mean, it was beyond disastrous. It was like, it was the most incredible pain one can feel. Like, because, you know, your pop growing up, that's your hero. And to have that taken away from you and then, you know, not experience that for the next 20-odd years, you know, you build up this sort of, you know, that's where, you know, I say in the line, you know, after the world, my defense came. You know, you don't want anybody to get closer. You don't want to experience that pain. So luckily for me, my mom had set up a meeting and I got to, you know, we got to meet up later on in life. And I got to get all those feelings out. We got to have a conversation. If I give anybody a gift, any one of us in that generation that grew up without their fathers or never got to meet their fathers or any one of their parents, you know, if I could give them a gift, that'd be a gift, because to let go of that sort of anger and that sort of pain is very healthy, you know. It was very healthy for me. And I believe everything happens for a reason, because a month later, my pop passed away. And had he died and I had that sort of anger still bottled up, I don't know how I would be as a functioning human being, you know, right now, today to day.
Right. Yeah. And it's stunning because in one of your lyrics, I won't get this right, it's on The American Gangster. And you talk about the pain you experience. And these, you know, these lyrics are where, you know, I buried the ashes, so to speak. And right. The palpable sense of hurt and pain that one can feel, the textures and tones of your songs really do communicate the immediacy of the emotion. And one of the remarkable things about this book is that even though you talk about, you know, the pose, the mask, the being the tough guy, and you talk about authenticity and being real on the one hand and yet wearing the mask on the other, that links you, of course, back to Paul Lawrence Dunbar, We Wear the Mask, and down to the Fugees for that matter. But the way you brilliantly talk about that, You talk about exposing one's own soul, so to speak, and the emotion that you can feel in hip hop and how real that is and making a connection to human beings. Tell us why that's such an important thing and why that draws from some of the pain you've had and your misfortune has been transformed into a gift for other people.
Yeah, because I think at the end of the day, once we take away the titles of who we are, even beyond color, once we take away the title beyond color, beyond gender, beyond anything, once you take away the titles of who we are, author, writer, this, that, you know, we basically share the same emotions. We share the same fears, abandonment, the same anxiety, the same aspirations, you know. That whole picket fence with the family and the Goodyear tree, I mean, the Goodyear tire swinging from the tree in the backyard. We all have the same dreams. And so once you strip all those things down and you're able to put that sort of emotion in music, that's how people relate to you. People relate to the truth. The tracks and the music is just, is the backdrop. It's the canvas on which we paint on. And for me, you know, being able to share those emotions with the world, it's almost like being a healer. I mean, as I'm healing other people as well. Then people to come up to me in my shows and just, you know, especially when I first started, because I didn't expect that sort of response. It was small when I first started. It was just me and, you know, my inner circle. And I was telling our story, and it was, you know, just hearing our story and hearing that effect that it had on them. I knew there were more people, but when they start really happening, you know, 6'8" guys coming up to me and you know, after the show with like tears in their eyes, say, like, I feel like you was looking through my window, and, you know, I relate to everything you're saying because it, you know, it happened to me. You know, it's an extraordinary feeling.
It is. And that extraordinary feeling, of course, of knowing that you've touched the nerve center of another human being. I think it was Henri Nouwen, who's a famous theologian, who said, we are wounded healers, that the blood that we shed and the wounds that we bear may be able to help somebody else. And as we listen to your music, we know in that sense your wounds have been made available to a larger community who identify
and
with
you. Not to cut you off, but that sort of thing, you know, Lloyd, Alfred Tennyson, and when you hear those sort of words, and these words have been here, you know, way before us, and, you know, the answer that I gave is the exact answer is, you know, what's the poet's name? I'm sorry. That you
Alfred
just
Lord
said,
Tennyson? Paul Laurence Dunbar, yes. Mm-hmm.
It's that human emotion. Once you separate who we are as individuals, we all have those same sort of feelings.
Yeah, that's powerful. Yeah. Henri Nouwen, Paul Laurence Dunbar, Alfred Lord Tennyson. That's from Jigga, y'all. No, you didn't expect that, dropping it like that, but that's what he does. We're talking to Jay-Z, one of the greatest, not only rappers and business icons, but one of the greatest figures in modern American and global culture. We're going to take a small break, and we're going to come back with more of the scintillating insight and the brilliant, I think, and shall we say world historical? That's what Hegel said. We just got a grasp of words here. World historical reflections on life that we live from Jay-Z. We'll be right back.
Let it bump, though. From standing on the corners bopping to driving some of the hottest cars New Yorkers ever seen.
Sean Carter was born December 4th, weighing in at 10 pounds, 8 ounces. He was the last of my four children, the only one who didn't give me any pain when I gave birth to him. And that's how I knew that he was a special child.
Hi, baby. What's wrong? You look like you've lost your best friend. Tell me, is it something that I've done again? You look like you've lost your best friend.
They say they never really miss you till you dead or you gone. So on that note, I'm leaving after the song. So you ain't gotta feel no way about Jay so long. But at least let me tell you why I'm this way. Hold on. I was conceived by Gloria Carter and Agnes Reeves, who made love under the sycamore tree, which makes me a more sicker MC and my mama would claim. At 10 pounds when I was born, I didn't give her no pain. Although through the years I gave her her fair share, I gave her first real scare. I made it for birth when I got here. She knows my purpose wasn't purpose. I ain't perfect, I care. But I feel worthless cause my shirts wasn't matching my gear. Now I'm just scratching the surface cause what's buried under there was a kid torn apart once his pop disappeared. I went to school, got good grades, could behave when I wanted, but I had demons deep inside that were raised when confronted. Hold on.
Sean was a very shy child growing up. He was into sports.
Welcome back to the Michael Eric Dyson Show. It is our distinct honor to have for this entire hour one of the greatest figures in modern American culture, not just in music, though he dominates that, not just in business, though he dominates that. He is a mogul. He is what Emerson called a self-rebegetting figure, which means he continues to recreate himself. He continues to improvise upon the elements of identity that he has both inherited, but certainly that he has now made. You know, Jay-Z, you started rapping early on, but you also joined, and you talk about this in the book brilliantly, the relationship between hustling and rapping. But, you know, you opened the book with a powerful explanation about what a cipher is. And what I love about you in the book, you say, look, I didn't know that that's what it was then. We didn't even call it that then. But you know, you were honest about where you were. You take us into the worldview of a young person who's growing up. So take us into that worldview where you get your first scent of rap, so to speak, and then how that was parallel to the hustling that you engaged in later on.
Yeah, the first time I heard, you know, my mom and pop had a huge record collection, and my mom, I think she had King Tim the Third, one of those. She had like one of the first rap records ever. But it wasn't until, you know, I happened upon this cipher right in front of my building, Marcy Projects. There were a bunch of kids standing around this one guy, his name was Slate. He's a bit older than me. And he's just taking these words and he's pulling them out the air and he's just throwing them all around and everyone's fascinated and everyone's, you know, hanging on his every word. And I just stood there and he just mesmerized the crowd for 45 minutes. Just sometimes it was, you know, it was funny, you know, hilarious. Sometimes it was insulting. It was almost like he was playing the dozens, but he was making these words match in a way that I hadn't experienced live before. And I knew, from that day then, I knew the power of words, and I started searching for words, and I was just enthralled by how he captivated and how he captivated that crowd for that long. And I thought, man, I can do that. And it just felt like the first time that our story was being told our way. You know, we listened to all those great records. We listened to The Temptations. We listened to Prince, Michael Jackson. We listened to all those in the house. And it almost felt like at that moment, you know, there would be a closer conversation that was to be had. And from that day on, it was like, you know, I don't know if I ever, of course, haven't fell out of love, but, you know, I don't know if I haven't thought about words in the same way since.
Wow. And that's one of the greatest wordsmiths of our generation. Let's take a listen to his exploration of the hustling lifestyle that has become dominant, that he claims is the truth of hip hop. Not the only truth, not the only story, but a central one that had been neglected even in the earlier history of hip hop. Let's listen to Can't Knock the Hustle.
Check. Yo, I'm making short-term goals when the weather falls. Yes, put away the leathers and put ice on the gold. Chilly with enough bail money to free a big willy. High stakes, I got more at stake than Philly. Shopping sprees, copping three. Deuce fever, IS's, fully loaded. Ah, yes, bouncing in the Lex Luger. Tire smoke like Buddha. 50 G's to the crap shooter. Skin can't fade me. Chrome stocks beaming. Through my peripheral, I see you scheming. Stop dreaming, I leave your body steaming. The end is fiending, what's the meaning? I'm leaning on any intervening. With the sound of my money machining, my cup runneth over with hundreds. I'm one of the intense, but I done it. Six digits and running, y'all don't want it. I got the Godfather flow, the Don Juan DeMarco. Swear to God, don't get it up.
I'm taking up this time.
I promise not to sing that Mary J. Blige hook for y'all. That's Can't Knock the Hustle.
You know, the strange thing about I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
The strange thing about Can't Knock the Hustle, my intention in writing that was I was really speaking to, you know, the guys in the street. I was in the street when I thought of that song. And at that time, you know, the hustlers, the street hustlers were making more money than the rappers. And I always had this love for rap, but it was almost like I was embarrassed to really say how much, you know, I really wanted to do it because, you know, at the time, you know, we were the guys, and we rappers was almost frowned upon because we were pulling up in Lexus and Benzes and all that, and rappers was jumping out of turtle tops and 12, you know, 12 of them. And we thought, man, these guys are working so hard and they're missing their sons and daughters' first steps and being away from their families. And, they, you know, everybody else is making money but them. This is before the big deals that Russell and Puff and every Master P and all of them were doing. So I couldn't really say how much I was in love with this art form. So I was telling guys in the street, you can't knock my hustle, because, you know, street hustling, that was my life, and rap was my hustle at the time. So the intention of writing that song was to tell them that, but I kind of disguised it with all the talk of things that we were doing every day.
Right, right. Now that's a remix even from the book, y'all. Y'all getting the straight Michael Eric Dyson Show remix of Hova decoding Can't Knock the Hustle. How cool is that? You talk in the book so very poignantly about an issue that a lot of people misunderstand. That's about the braggadocious nature of the self-assertion of hip-hop. And you say it's not just about, you know, although it of course includes that, I'm better than you, I'm doper than you, I'm fresher than you, or whatever the current vernacular is, but you say it's also about the construction of a persona, of a mask, of a personality that people can identify with. Chuck D, as great a rapper as he was literally telling a story, narrating more like a reporter and a journalist, and people were moved by his words but didn't construct a persona around him because it was literally and objectively true. Whereas Jay-Z is not Sean Carter, though they converge. And you brilliantly discuss the convergence of Jay-Z and Sean Carter and how you use that persona to express some broader truths. Tell us about your theory and understanding of that.
You know, I have to take you back to the beginning. In the beginning of rap, you know, the DJ was the man. The DJ was the guy. You couldn't just come and your whole job as an MC, a master of ceremony, was to talk about how great the DJ was. It was the DJ show. That's how it really started. So you had to have some sort of, it was almost a joust for you to be able to talk about the DJ. So you had to almost battle your way, you know, in the position to say, you know, not bad meaning bad, my DJ Jam Master J. I mean, even if you look at those early records, Eric B and Rakim, right, the DJ's name came before the rapper's name. So
that's true.
That's where it was built up. It came from that nature. You know, the braggadocious came from battling. You had to say, I'm better than you, and I'm the one. I deserve the right to talk about the DJ. So that's where that's the history of that art form. And now as it evolved and you take it forward, you know, now you have people whose lives has been turned around by so many different things, so it complicates the matters even worse. So you take the foundation of it, then you add these other things, hustling and, you know, what's going on, and some guys, you know, reporting on what's going on in the street, you know, other people's aspiration, the embarrassment of poverty, you know, all these other things, and you add that into the flavor. You know, that's why it's so complex. That's why with this book, I really wanted to give it context. I'm not saying every decision that we make or made, you know, is absolutely right, because that's wrong. We're 16, 17 years old most of the time when we get a record deal, and, you know, we make plenty of mistakes. But given the context, you know, then you can accurately judge it. You know, some people just browse over rap and hear buzzwords and, you know, get turned off by those words and just, you know, take a big paintbrush out and just, you know, paint this broad picture of what it is. But it's complex. It's like life, you know, it's not black and white. You know, for me, you know, I started out just trying to master techniques. You know, I didn't have enough life experiences for music, so I was just being a technical rapper. And then when I got some life experiences, you know, those two things converged. That's where, you know, the hustler and, you know, Sean Carter and Jay-Z, whatever that is, you know, it all converged. So sometimes you have these deep stories about life and the emotions and the paranoia and, you know, things like regrets and soon you understand and where I'm from, I mean, and you must love me. And then sometimes you have the boastful party raps of Big Pimpin' and Give It to Me, you know. And when you give all those things context, you can really see where it all comes from.
No doubt. And you know, there's so much popping out to me right now. The technical aspects of rap you talk about, I'm reminded of how in the book you speak about Talib Kweli and Common, both rappers who you say are great rappers that you really enjoy, who are brilliant artists in their own right. But you make a distinction there that's very important. And on that moment of clarity where you are speaking about how people are dissing you for being so commercially successful, and yet they're still hollering at you. And, you know, truth be, if Skill Soul lyrically, I be Talib Kweli, I like to rap like Common Sense, but I sold 5 mil. I ain't rap like Common Sense. Not only the brilliant wordplay there, but what you do is give us in the book a further clarification that I want you to share with us, because it wasn't a diss of Talib or Common. You were saying they were technically proficient, but the big story, the song, the big song has to come into play. And therefore, those who are so-called sometimes conscious rappers may be reticent to grasp hold of a kind of commercially energized song that will get over their ideas and won't allow them to be so abstract on the one hand, allow them to be accessible and to connect with the broader audience on the other. Speak more about that.
Yeah, being in the music business, people, you know, I guess I coined the phrase of dumbed down lyrics, you know, and I think it kind of took on this connotation of something that's simple. It's very difficult to converge the two. You know, sometimes, you know, even pop songs, they have great melodies and no words. The creation of that melody is just as difficult as creating, you know, some of those Common and Talib lyrics. So that you have two things on the opposite side of each other, a great melody and great lyrics. My thing was, what I was saying was, you know, I'm not dissing that, or I'm not dissing commercial music. I'm going to take, you know, a great melody with great lyrics and converge the two, which is a very difficult thing to do, because, you know, if the pop guys could write deep and great lyrics, they would. And if the guys who write great lyrics can, you know, make that translate all around the world with a great melody, you know, I believe they would for the most part. So it's very difficult to do the two. And so I was speaking about that when I'm talking about Common, in the sense of, you know, you hear the hustler coming, but I sold 5 mil. I ain't been rhyming like Common since. It was almost like a sarcastic little smirk, you know, within the lyrics to say, look, I did both. You know, I made a great song and with great lyrics, which is a very difficult thing to do, a balancing act of sorts.
Well, it's extremely difficult and complicated, as you've just said. And a lot of people, until this book, I would suggest, may have missed that in hip-hop as an art form in general, and perhaps even with you, because there are some artists who are known, say Nas, or, you know, being explicitly political, Chuck D, even Tupac at moments, and they see you talking about the hustling life. But as you said on the Black Album, when you break down my lines, you know, I ain't jumping around like, say, a Busta Rhymes, and I ain't doing this, and I'm not animated, and so on and so forth. But when you look at the sheer artistry of what you do, and one of the brilliant things you do in this book is break all this stuff down, homonyms and synonyms and metonymy, and I mean, all this complicated linguistic stuff, you just break it straight down. You show what you're doing. I'm saying, if anybody reads this book and can't understand the breadth of your comprehension of your craft, the supreme control you exercise over the linguistic array of talents you have, and on top of that, you meant to do it. This ain't no mistake. You didn't just happen into those double entendres and the way in which you break down the lines. So you have, I think, in one sense, been underrated. How hard is it to believe Jay-Z has been underrated in terms of your sheer linguistic ability? But I would argue, even though you are claimed by many to be the greatest rapper ever, it's still not enough when we talk about what you're able to do. How do you balance that out? How do you know how complex you are and complicated you are, and people are sometimes missing that? What do you do? How do you adjust that in your own mind? Do you say, hey, they'll catch it later when they read this book, they'll understand it. When they break down my lines 30 years from now, they understand it. How do you reconcile that in your own mind?
I think, you know, people with deep understanding and listening and peers and writers and, you know, fellow poets have gotten me along. You know, long as someone recognizes it, you know, I believe that everyone, some get it today, some get it tomorrow. And that feeling of that, you know, was gratifying for me. You know, some people would come up and say, man, the way you said that and kept that in time and you know, just that sort of thing. This decoded process was happening slowly, you know, over my whole entire career. The reason I wrote the book was for the world to understand us. You know, it's built around me because I'm telling the story, but it's really the story of a generation of poets, a generation of kids who grew up in, you know, the Reaganomics and all these things and all the effects that it had to us. A generation of rappers who had said F the police and people said, man, they're just so hostile and this and that. And then later, the Rodney King beatings decoded F the police. That was a way that decoded that situation. And then it gave context to it. And people was like, wait, maybe they're not just saying F the police for no reason. Maybe this stuff is going on in the neighborhoods. And this is why they're acting out. And this is why they're angry. And this is why we hear their passion and love and, you know, all these things on a record. So for me, to answer your question was the people that were relating to those songs in a deeper meaning and decoding them on their own kept me going. I knew that eventually everybody would understand the level of, you know, complexity that was in the approach and the thoughtfulness and to care so much about the music, to treat it in, you know, with such respect. I'm going to make a great melody. I'm going to hide some lyrics in there. I'm going to talk about something real. I'm going to put real emotions in it. You know, at the same time, it's going to go by as if nothing really happened. People listen to songs of mine, you know the words, but don't, you know, but really don't know the meaning and enjoy them. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, right. I mean, and you make this so evident in the book, that even on the percussive level, even on the melodic level, even on the harmonic level, even on just lining it out and beating it down and the words you use, you give an example from Run DMC and the words that, you know, may not make a whole bunch of sense in one level, but it makes sonic sense. And you break that down. So when we come back, we're going to have more from Jay-Z, who will decode some of the great and brilliant insight that he has condensed into these marvelously luminous and yet scintillating lyrics that he has presented to us. We're talking to Jay-Z, one of the greatest artists of our generation, and certainly a man who now has global reach. We're honored to have him on the Michael Eric Dyson Show, and when we come back, we're going to talk to him more about Decoded, his tremendous new book.
Respect this here. Check. I'm from where the hammers rung, news cameras never come. You and your mans hung in every verse in your rhyme, where the grams were slung. Vanish every summer, where the blue vans would come. We throw the work in the can and run.
Next time on the Michael Eric Dyson Show, we'll spend the entire hour wrapping up our look at black male academic achievement with a group of college students, with Mike Green, a columnist who believes parents need to take more responsibility, and with the author of the book Raising Him Alone, David Miller. That's next time on the Michael Eric Dyson Show. Welcome back to the Michael Eric Dyson Show.
Yeah, I'm out at Brooklyn. Now I'm down in Tribeca, right next to the Narrow. But I'll be hood forever. I'm the new Sinatra. And since I made it here, I can make it anywhere. Yeah, they love me everywhere. I used to cop in Harlem. All of my Dominicanos right there up on Broadway. Pulled me back to that McDonald's. Took it to my stash spot, 560 State Street. Catch me in the kitchen like a Simmons whipping pastry. Cruising down A Street, off-white Lexus. Driving so slow, but BK is from Texas. Me, I'm out that Bed-Stuy, home of that boy Biggie. Now I live on Billboard and I brought my boys with me. Say what up to Tata, still sipping my top, sitting courtside, Knicks and Nets give me high five. Again, I be spiked out, I could trip a referee. Tell by my attitude that I most definitely from
heads was blowing that joint everywhere. If they wasn't from New York, they were that day. Everybody was from New York. I can make the Yankee hat more famous than a Yankee can. Ah, even Derek Jeter had to get some love up on that. We're joined this hour by rapper, businessman. I'm not a businessman, right? He's not a businessman. He's a businessman. So let him handle his business. Damn. We're talking to author Jay-Z. He's talking about his new book, Decoded, part memoir, part art book, part thoughtful and insightful commentary on the hip-hop generation. It's not simply about him, though much of the mystery surrounding some of the lyrics, and I say some because there are 36 songs, I believe, I stand to be corrected in this book. He's going to have to write about, I don't know, maybe 150 more decodeds to get through the songbook. Decoded part 20, you know, so we can understand. Let me ask you a question in regard to that. What was the selection process for the 36 songs? Because what you did was brilliant, I think. You gave us some of the familiar songs, and then you gave us a lot of stuff we didn't know. So was there a rhyme or reason, so to speak, behind the songs that you chose to feature in this book?
Yeah, I started with some of the songs that needed the most decoding, but I try to stick close to the central story, and the story is about that a generation of kids that grew up during the same time hip-hop grew up, and, you know, why our voices sounded the way they were, why they were scarred, why they were frustrated, why they were angry, why they were happy at times, why they were lacking self-esteem, you know, why they were so strong in the face of tremendous odds. So I try to start with that basic story, and then I of course wanted to give some things that people hadn't heard before, but the basic story was I wanted to start with the tell a story of that generation.
And when you tell the story of that generation, you know, there was a recent study done, and we've been focusing on education on my show for the last week, that said only 12% of fourth grade black boys are proficient in reading, and only 12% of black eighth grade boys are proficient in math. And even when they adjusted for income, it didn't matter. White boys living in poverty do as well as black boys who are not living in poverty. And a lot of people say, well, one of the big things we can look at here is the culture of hip hop and how it's presented this oppositional culture. And you know the story, you know the blame, you know how hip hop has been hit. And you and I have talked about this many times, about the assault upon hip-hop. What do you make of people who say, yeah, but the big difference with young black boys is they're listening to too much of that rap stuff and they're not being inspired to get their lesson?
Well, that's, for me, a feint. You know, that's a way to mask the real problem. The real problem is opportunity, you know, with given the opportunity, generational opportunities. To break it down on a simplistic level, if I'm an athlete, you know, 9 times out of 10, I'm going to pass some sort of genetics down to my kid. So through generations of us being neglected and our schools being the worst ever and all these other things that happen, the thing that people pull out is music, you know, poets talking about what's really happening in the neighborhood. And of course, there are some that exaggerate, and there's some without any thought. Just like anything, life has balance. You know, there's some things, there's some food that's good for you and some that's bad for you. It's just life. So of course, something like hip hop, you know, which is easy to attack because of some of the language and because of some of the violence surrounding it. Of course, violence surrounds hip-hop because it comes from a place of violence and struggle. And, you know, instead of fixing the real problem, they attack the thing that's easiest to attack because of its language or its mystique of this gangster rap and this violence. You know, so that's just a feint to me.
And you brilliantly addressed this in Decoded at length because you speak about the opportunity gap. You talk about the racial issues and as well as the class issues that are involved. And you're self-critical in a way that is both refreshing and revealing. A lot of people think that, you know, hip-hoppers are all about not only the braggadocious element, but also about being defensive. And you talk about, I think, quite revealing self-criticisms in this book. You talk about how black people have internalized the notion that light and bright is better than darker. And you talk about one of your lyrics that talks about all the wavy light-skinned girls are liking me now. I mean, you're tough on yourself. That's not, I mean, you really, you know, you hit yourself hard on that because you talk about the internalized poison.
I don't think
there.
You can have a discussion without self-reflection, you know, because we're not perfect. We're not perfect human beings. I've made wrong decisions. I've done wrong things. I've said wrong things. You know, if you can't self-analyze, then you can't, I don't believe you can have an opinion on anything. It's just honest. What I try to do in this book is just be as honest as I can. I just put it out there and, you know, it's for you to say, you know, whether it's right or wrong. You know, it's just really for my life. I'm just trying to put it out there and, you know, straight and raw. It is what it is.
Well, you do that in many places. And in presenting, you know, what your life has been, you expose to us the process by which, you know, you began to evolve and mature and understand, you know, what your potential was and what your struggles have been about. And not only your struggles, but the struggles, as you've already indicated, of a generation. You talk about how Biggie, you know, one of the greatest things he ever said was not even in a rhyme. But at the beginning, you know, this is for all those people who called the police on me when I was standing outside my building trying to hustle to feed my daughter and so on. And, you know, you give a lot of analysis in this book to different rappers.
Can I stop you right there? Because I wanted to give you a great compliment as it relates to what Biggie said right there. You know, for a lot of us, we felt like, you know, the people who had higher education or who had escaped, you know, some of the things that we were trying to escape, looked down upon us and judged us in a way that we were like, you hurt by it. You know, one of the reasons I wrote this book, because I had a great conversation with Oprah Winfrey about rap and about its lyrics and everything. And I said to her, well, I understand your position on it, but at least give us the platform. You know, we look up to you, you know, as someone, a leader. We champion what you do, and you won't even give us the conversation. That's what hurts. We're not upset with you. We're hurt by the fact that, you know, we look to you as a hero. And if we're doing something wrong, have the conversation with us. Tell us where we're going wrong, or give us the chance to explain why we said this, or why NWA said F the police, or why. Give us a chance to explain. That's all we want, is the audience. And you, as someone I've seen on CNN and all these different places, explaining, you know, in a way that we can't vocalize. You know, some of us, we know we're feeling, and we try to feel, and sometimes we don't communicate that correctly, you know, whether it be, you know, our level of education or use of words or anger that's stopping us from really articulating what's really on our mind. And you, in the most distinguished way, articulating that for us and on behalf of us. And I just wanted to say that.
That's very kind of you. We love you, to be sure, and the people who listen. But I want to thank you personally for that very gracious and remarkably compassionate comment there. And coming from you, that means the world to me, my friend. That certainly does. And this is what you do so well. I mean, not only engaging a culture that may not understand, you know, people who don't understand what you're up to, what the people in your generation are up to. You do an epilogue in this book where you address Oprah Winfrey, and you do it graciously and kindly. But what I love about you is that you still stay on message and you maintain your point. And she doesn't like the N-word. She sees in it the horror of slavery and of the demonization of black people. You don't deny that. You understand that that's what's being communicated, but you also understand that that's a word whose power has to be argued over. And when you talk about the N-word, and I in my generation, I'm 52 years old, I tell people the first time I heard the N-word was not from a rapper. It was from a preacher talking about his people. These N's today wore me out. So the reality is, you know, let's be real about that. You maintain that message throughout. Tell us why you continue to use that word, why it has such specific resonance that no other word really can fill in. You can't say partner, you can't say brother, you can't say my man. Nothing fits quite like that word. Tell us why it continues to be relevant, not only to hip hoppers, but for this generation.
We had taken a word and we have removed the power from it. We turned it into something different. That's what hip hop can do. Take the language that you hear all the time and give it new life and make it something else. You know, I've always believed that the action and the intent, not the words, is what need to be fixed. If we take the word away from the English language, let's say we remove the word without fixing the action, that's like wiping your windshield off when you need gas. It's like the wrong, it does nothing for the problem. You know, action and intent is what's powerful. I mean, words, of course, but the action behind it. If we remove the N-word, then it's going to be porch monkey. It'd just be replaced by another word. So we must fix the action. That's what I believe. I always believe.
Yeah, that's a powerful notion. And for those of you who have not yet read the book, please go get it, because Jay-Z deals with this with such intelligence and such balance. and such power. And it's similar to what I was saying when the NAACP was bearing the word. I was like, it's going to be like Jesus. It's going to get up in 3 days. You're buried, it gets resurrected. Hey, N-word, we thought we had buried you. No, I am right. with you to the end of the earth. That where right. I am, there you may be also. So that's you can't right. really bury a word. It's going right. to come back at you. And there's a brilliant discussion in this book about that. Let's take a listen to Big Pimpin', one of the signature tunes that you made along with Bun B and Pimp C, and talk about some of the complicated messages that were put forth and how you've since talked about what they mean to you now. Let's listen to Big Pimpin'.
You know I thug 'em, some love 'em, leave 'em, cause I don't need 'em. Take 'em out the hood, keep 'em looking good, but I don't beat 'em. First time they fuss, I'm breathing. Talking about what's the reason? I'm a pimpin' every sense of the word. Better trust and believe 'em. In the cut where I keep 'em, till I need it.
That's Big Pimpin', and I want to give you all a little back history why I played that, and I wanted to talk to Jay-Z about that, because he just talked about the N-word and how complicated that was and how the evolution of that term. But when we come to the misogyny, this is where you're also quite complicated and sophisticated, I think, in this book, because, of course, you've been hit for misogynistic lyrics and stuff, and again, given yourself criticism. You know, I saw recently where you, in an interview, said, look, what was I thinking? Though, of course, those lyrics are offensive. Tell us about your own evolution in regard to these lyrics in particular and why that was such a huge song, however, for your career.
What I really try to get forth, and I keep saying it, I feel like a broken record, but, you know, it must be said again and again, is what I try to give is context. What people have to understand when songs like... First of all, it's a very entertaining and fun song, I must say. But, you know, songs like Big Pimpin' and where they come from, you know, we come from a place where, you know, our relationships are not those of built out of love. They're built out of convenience, and they're built out of fascination with whatever, you know. It comes from a place where the girls, they're not women yet, have low self-esteem. The guys have low self-esteem, so they can't teach the woman how to have self-esteem, and vice versa. And a lot of these relationships happen on the road. You never see the girl again, and, you know, all these things happen. You know, most rappers get a deal when they're 16 and 17 years old, so they're not talking about a mature level of love. They're talking about a fleeting love that's, you know, 15 minutes, if that. And the challenge I put forth for all of us is, you know, songs like Ain't No become Big Pimpin', that become Song Cry, that become, you know, Bonnie and Clyde, that, you know, that you even, you know, see the evolution in music. We can't evolve as human beings and not let that infiltrate our music. A lot of artists, and I'll put the challenge forth to them, is a lot of artists, they still try to record like they're 18 years old when they're 30, and when they should be trying to evolve as human beings. They can't just evolve as human beings and without letting the music evolve, the music that we love. We have to evolve, you know, as musicians also. So you have to look at a song like Big Pimpin' and say, man, you know, I don't feel like that today. But, you know, at the time, you know, I don't apologize for it. It was, you know, something I went through, and I still enjoy the record. I still perform it today. But you have to look at some of the songs I made. Again, you know, even in my music, my songs evolved. You know, my last album, Big Pimpin', wasn't on there. Venus versus Mars was on there. It was a much different sort of relationship.
Let's end where we began with the personal and the individual. And the quite painful but nonetheless revealing struggle over becoming oneself when a parent is not present. And, you know, our producer here, executive producer DeVar Ardalan, her 21-year-old daughter is leaving to see her father for the first time since she has been an infant. And, you know, what do you say to the Samiras and any young person out there who has the courage to really try to reconnect with their parent? You are so moving in describing what that meant to you. Can you give some encouragement to all of those young people who are confronting their parents for the first time, giving up the pain and the agony and the anger and maybe claiming the love and the redemption?
Yeah, I think it has to happen. You know, I said earlier, if I could give a gift, that would be the gift to reconnect with the love and the parent, or, you know, from which you come from, have a chance to you know, let go of all that anger. I don't know who I would be today if I didn't have that chance. Like I said, when I spoke to my pop and he passed away a month later, I believe everything in life happens for a reason. I believe that meeting happened on that day, you know, because some universal force knew that I wouldn't be able to grow as a human being until I let go all of that anger. Until you can let go of that anger, you're not, there's no way you can reach your fullest potential because of the walls that you put up. Whether you know it or not, they're there. There's no way for you to let people love you or for you to, you know, give that love outward if you're guarding your heart. You don't want that feeling to ever happen again, that loss, that sense of abandonment, that feeling. So I applaud her, and I think this is a great day for her. My advice would be just say everything that's on your mind and, you know, all the anger, all everything that happened, you know, get some sort of explanation, some sort of, you know, a way to let all that anger go. And then, you know, for me, you know, it was easy for me to forgive once I let that anger go.
Those are the words of a remarkably mature and wise young man. And he once uttered something like, I used to think that rapping at 38 was ill, but last year alone I made 38 mil. I know I'm not quite 38, but still the flow's so special. Got a 38 feel. Ted, come, that man is good. What is he saying? That boy good. We've been joined this hour by none other than hip-hop artist, impresario, mogul, and now author Jay-Z. He's been talking with us about his new book, Decoded, a look into not only his life and lyrics, but into the hip-hop community at large. Jay-Z, thanks so much for coming on and blessing the mic on the Michael Eric Dyson Show.
Thank you, sir, and thank you for all you do once again.
Like a Siamese twin when it end, I'ma stand as a man, never dying on my knees, last of a dying breed. So let the champagne pop. I party for a while, now I'm back to the block. And I'm getting it, I'm getting it.
That's it for today. The Michael Eric Dyson Show is a production of WEAA with funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm your host, Michael Eric Dyson. Until tomorrow, be good to yourself.